This is Pure Decking for Thursday, October the 17th of this year. This is the show about stuff that interests me, like descending to a police state, information security, and the various ways of screwing with the normals. I'm Morps, and tonight we have Sard, Madman, and Suave. And Sard, I stole your beer of choice. I got a Shock Top Raspberry Wheat tonight.
Ah, nice. I have the original regular Shock Top, so I guess we're even.
Yeah, okay.
Purple Haze is a better version of what you're drinking, Morps.
Really? I'll have to try that.
Yes.
What you got, Suave?
I am drinking Te Bag Splendid Scotch Whiskey.
Oh, very nice.
No idea how to pronounce that.
Very nice. Madman, you got anything interesting you're drinking?
I grabbed one of Mama's Little Yellow Pills from the Oscar Blues Brewing Company.
What the hell is that?
I think he's on meth.
Adderall, actually.
Oh! Lovely. All right, so just a little bit of station news. I'm going to be doing a lot of work on the back end and the broadcast system. The broadcast system is fairly straightforward because we only rebuilt the thing like 14 times now, so that shouldn't be, the downtime from that should be minimal. And the back end stuff, I'm going to try to minimize the downtime, but it's going to be worth it because it's going to be really cool with some of the stuff I'm going to be able to do at the station when I'm done with it. And it's going to open up the door for adding some new stuff later. And it'll let me save a little bit of money because we can kill up one of the extra services we were using to run the station when I get it all done. So, just don't be surprised if the stream is going up and down a lot in the next week. Because we're actually going to change the address to something a little bit nicer so that when you go to punch in the stream URL in your smartphone, it's a little bit easier to do stuff like that. So, okay, I honestly have no idea how long it's going to take me to write the config files and get all that straightened out, but I imagine it's not going to take me that long, so. That'll be neat, and when it's done, I can then put Sard in front of it and say, okay, good luck.
Oh, I look forward to that.
it's not that bad,
no,
really.
I know. It's all good.
So that'll be fun. Actually, there's going to be some really neat stuff we're going to be able to do when I get that done. Specifically, one of the first things I'm going to set up is kind of a self-contained backup system so that if something happens to our primary broadcast virtual machine, this little built-in secondary can take over and at least keep something going on the stream as opposed to, you know, just having the thing go down.
Yeah, very cool.
So... yeah,
so it's going to start playing the Badger song whenever the station goes down.
Well, actually, that might be a thing. Is we pick a track set of tracks that if it's only playing like the same four tracks over and over again, we know something's wrong. You know, that kind of thing. Or maybe I'll have it like every three tracks say, you know, you're running on the backup stream or something, just to give us a heads up that hey, it's falling down and somebody needs to go kick it. So. But yeah, that'll be neat when we get it done. I'm gonna use that liquid soap system we tried to move to, but as just one layer as opposed to the whole thing. So it'll be
right.
Neat.
Right.
So as far as our discussion goes, Rofax actually sent me a pretty good one. So I thought we'd use it. He sent in the note. He sent me, he said you could discuss if tech journalism has reduced the NSA to a punchline. Initially, most podcasts he listens to were genuinely upset with the NSA for mass surveillance. Now, though they pay lip service to the offense, there is no serious discussion. They just use them as a joke, such as, oh, my computer crashed, I better go ask the NSA for my backup. And though Rofaxon says he loves the NSA jokes, he feels that most people are trivializing it, and just instead of justified indignation, they're just kind of accepting it. So he's kind of got a point there, and I've got a couple of articles here, just the fun bits, from the Slate Weekly. The head of the NSA admitted before a congressional committee this week that he lied back in June when he claimed the agency's phone surveillance system had thwarted 54 terrorist plots or events. And from the Washington Post, the National Security Agency is harvesting hundreds of millions of contact lists from personal email and instant messaging accounts around the world. The collection program, which has not been disclosed before, intercepts email addresses and buddy lists from instant messaging services as they move across global data links. So, yeah, it just keeps going and going. And I believe FIFSA just approved them to keep going with all this stuff for another year, 6 months, something like that.
6 months. That's six another months. 6 months.
Yeah.
Because FISA doesn't know how to say no.
Have they ever actually said no?
They're like a drunk sorority girl.
They haven't said no, but they've said yes and then put an addendum on why that was a bad idea.
We're not going to say you can't do this, but you really shouldn't do it. Oh, fucking joke. Anyways, the reason everybody's making a joke out of it and laughing it off is anybody who's been involved in any tangential shape, form, manner, whatever, anybody who's been around, you know, with InfoSec or the hacking scene for a bit, has pretty much just assumed this has been going on forever. I mean, yeah, we all thought our stuff was being monitored back in the day, especially in the early BBS days, and you know, you didn't know which ones were real and which ones were traps, and oh, and you know, you still kind of see that with some websites and FTP servers and torrent sites and shit. So, you know, you go back all the way back to the 90s, and you find examples of people thinking your IRC chats were being logged or bugged, and a lot of them were. Or Telnet sessions, or, you know, whatever people were using to communicate. And the FBI did run a lot of BBSs. So, I mean, well, you can just...
There's one big difference. On that one, you're logging into a BBS that's run by the government. They might not be honest about it, but they're not going after private ones and just taking
Well, no, they would log into the private ones and look around. I mean,
they still have public access. It's not like a closed network or anything.
That's
right?
True. That's very true. But yeah, I mean, it's still the same concept that they've been monitoring what people do with their computers for a very, you know, ever since it got interesting.
Oh yeah.
So this seeing all the documents come out and all the, you know, it's yeah, it's kind of a kick in the dick, but for, you know, people who've been around for a bit, who've been keeping an eye on things, it's a chance for all of us to go, we told you. See? Look, we told you they were doing this. Here's the proof. It's not so much that anybody didn't expect this. It's just that we're finally vindicated.
You know, I want to add on to that. You know, I don't think that comedy is necessarily detracting from the issue at all. Well, and one thing, comedy is always comes from tragedy. You don't see a joke about a happy circumstance. It's always an unfortunate circumstance. And, you know, this is an extremely unfortunate circumstance, so it makes a really good target for jokes. And, yeah, I guess that's all I got to say.
Well, if you can't laugh about it, you're going to cry about it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's terrible. It's absolutely fucking horrible that they're doing this. I mean, they're flat out lying about it, then admitting they lied and nothing comes of it. It's like Mason was saying in the chat room. It's like all the BBS used to say, if you're a government employee, you're not allowed to use the system. I remember seeing that, but I mean, so what? Bullshit. I mean, it's not enforceable. Nobody would care. And if you ever tried to bring it up in court and said, well, we said in the terms of service, government employees weren't allowed to use this, they just ignore it. They just throw it out. They don't care. Like, well, you violated terms of service. Well, so what? We were enforcing the law. So, Yeah, it's sort of like police are allowed to kick in doors and shit. So I don't see that as, I mean, it was never tested, but I don't think it ever would have been. It never would have been a thing. So I don't know. What you really should be pissed about, though, is the general lack of interest. You didn't see a mass exodus from Facebook and Google. You didn't see everyone suddenly switching off email and going to something else. You didn't see everyone going out and saying, gee, I should figure out how TrueCrypt works. Instead, you see just everybody going, yeah, well, I guess they're monitoring us. I've got nothing to hide. Oh, well. I mean, you know, it's like, oh, well, I guess they're going to see what the porn I look at is. I mean, you know, nobody cares. So that's the part that should piss you off. Of course they're monitoring it. They're the government. They've been trying to turn us into a police state for a while now. This is just another step in that. It's just like all the cameras everywhere. I mean, it's Big Brother. What do you expect? They see an opportunity and they're taking it. So I don't know. What do you guys think?
I think the news should cover it a bit more. That's one reason a lot of people are blasé about it. I don't think a lot of actual Americans know how much metadata the government's collecting and what all can be done with that.
And what they're describing as quote-unquote metadata.
Just because they're not getting possible word-for-word on what your conversations are doesn't mean what they're getting isn't valuable or personal. Like, knowing where you are second of the day, it's pretty big.
But the thing is, they are getting the full conversation. They're just not, they're just supposedly not reading it or not listening to it. They wait until they go back and get a court order to go back to the file they saved. They've got the file. They're just supposedly checking with the court before they open it. So
there's no possibility of abuse for something like that.
No.
You know, I'm sure it's totally fine.
Oh, yeah.
The NSA's already trust the government spying on their girlfriends.
Yeah. Yeah, what'd they call that? Love int or something like that?
Yeah. It's like, I know I bugged a phone illegally, but it was my wife. I thought she was screwing around on me.
Yeah.
What do you think, Sard?
No, man, I think exactly what you guys have been saying. I don't know if the, I don't follow a lot of the mainstream media, so I don't know how much, like you guys are saying, if they've been covering it or not, but I've definitely
not
seen
all.
All
they've talked about for the past, I don't know, 3 weeks is, oh my God, the government shut down, the Republicans are evil. That's right. All I've heard on television and news for like half this month.
And then you're going to get the conspiracy theorists that are going to go and say, well, look, they're diverting everyone's attention over to this thing so that the NSA can continue doing what they're going to be doing and all
If they're diverting attention from anything, it's how badly that healthcare site launch went.
Right, that too.
But
I don't know, man. I guess, like you said, hopefully it'll make... It's definitely, I've seen some more people say, oh, you know, and kind of wake up a little bit, but it's not... It's people that are on the internet and actually give a shit about that. It's not going to be, you know, Bill Blow down the street. It's not going to be your grandma or your grandpa or your parents or anything like that. It's going to be people that use the internet every day. It's going to be people that actually care about the internet and what it means and understand what how much of a powerful tool it is.
That's something they need to realize. They are using the internet whether they know it or not. Every time they send a text on the phone,
right,
or do a financial transaction.
Yeah, then that's a very good point. There's a lot of people that use it that don't even understand that they are using it.
That's true. And I mean, it's just like your car, though. I mean, how many people would, you know, you pop the hood open, they're you know, they faint. Like, a lot of the stuff they use every day works, so they don't understand why they should care about it. But I mean, I understand that concept, because I deal with that daily. But
I understand not knowing the mechanics of the internet, but not caring that the government is looking at everything that you do. So,
well, I mean,
I'm a law-abiding citizen. I still don't want them watching me crap.
I would prefer them not to do that. But, I mean, if you explain it in terms of it's like they're opening everyone's mail and reading it, then restuffing the envelope and sending it back along. I wonder how many people would get upset with that analogy, because at least people would understand that analogy, right? Oh, well, we're not actually reading it. We're just taking a picture. Turns out they do that anyway. Well, they take the picture of the closed envelopes. They actually do that. They don't, you know, so that what they're doing is X sent letter to X or X sent correspondent to X. They're not opening the envelopes and seeing what's in them, but they are taking the pictures. They do that. So it's the analogy is not even that far off.
I did not know that they did that.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't either. That's interesting.
Yeah, they do that. They take a picture of them, or at least in area in like some of the higher traffic cities.
Right. Huh.
I'm not sure that's every piece of mail, but certainly places like Washington, New York, yeah, they do.
Well,
they do a lot of that.
All they have to do is it at all the major hubs.
Right.
That's really probably, I think that's what it is, because I know it's not everything, but I know they document a lot of it.
Well, like if you do the major hubs, that's going to be like 95% of all the mail that's going through the states.
It's been a little while since I read the article, so I don't remember the exact details of it. I just remember reading that they're photographing most of the mail. So, you know, they don't go back and look at it unless they're, you know, looking for something. But I think I think that one came out of the whole anthrax scare. Okay, great. We're starting to get documentation of what the government is doing just because of the Snowden stuff. But can we get a couple of people like Snowden for, say, Google and Facebook and Microsoft and, every ISP and AT&T and, you know, everybody out there who handles our communication? Can we get some leaks of what they're doing? I mean, because it's bad enough the government's doing it, but you know these companies are doing it too.
Well, there's a difference. I'm not forced to do business with Time Warner or Comcast.
Your data is going over one of their links, whether you mean it to or not, because they're on the backbone. But you're right, they don't know who that is, so keep going with your thought.
Well, my thought is I can choose a different carrier, a different company, if they start doing something I dislike enough to change. But switching countries is a bit more difficult.
That's
how
a good point.
Most governments won't let you become a citizen of a different country unless you have specialized skills they want.
That's true. So I see
we're the
going
easiest
there.
Country to immigrate to, and if you have no specific skill set that we really desire, and we don't give you refugee status, it could take decades to legally immigrate here. And we are literally the easiest country to move into. And get citizenship. I have to throw citizenship in there, because just living in Canada is not hard. It might even be fun. Art, is it fun? When I say sorry, suave, is it fun?
I was just going to say, not me, bro.
Yes, it is.
You've been teased for Canadian sorry. You're going to need to, you know, get yourself a shotgun and ride around for a bit, scream America, fuck yeah, just to wash that up.
Yeah, I got to set the record straight now.
I don't know. I just, the reason nobody's up in arms about it is because it's so pervasive and it's so crazy. Nobody really knows what to do about it. I mean, yeah, we can bitch and moan about it, but that gets old. I mean, I am so tired of every time I go looking for decking stories, I'm purposely ignoring shit about Snowden and WikiLeaks and Anonymous just because I'm so tired of seeing all of it. And it's not just
bitching, moaning. We're not holding any elected officials accountable. No one's going to...
Nope, Madman cut out there.
BISA. They are over the courts. Have you heard anyone really being reamed through since 2010 about, you're a congressman and you voted to spy on me?
No, nobody cares.
Tea Party candidates won on that and fiscal responsibility, but since 2010, no one's even bringing it up.
Yeah.
The president can stop it all with a word. He doesn't even need Congress. This is all falling under the executive branch. He could go over to the NSA and say, stop spying on people without cause. You're violating the Fourth Amendment. I will have you shot. Not happening.
I would love to hear Obama say, I will have you shot. I just want a soundbite of him saying that.
And you know what? I bet you whoever they bring in to replace him is not going to do a thing about it either.
Probably not. All the bad things Bush was doing, which, like signing statements and all that crap, Obama continued even though he said he wasn't going to.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's just human temptation. You get in that position of power. It's like, yeah, you know, I said I wasn't going to do this, but that looks like a lot of fun. I mean...
like, the precedent's been more set. Y'all say? Didn't impeach the last guy, so you're not going to impeach me over it.
Pretty much. So, all right, let's go ahead and move on to news stories here. First one up is from Huffington Post. After Google announced on Friday that it will start putting people's names and faces into online ads, some Google Plus users decided not to take the news lying down. The few who still use Google's Facebook clone protested the move by switching their Google Plus profile pictures to images of the company's executive chairman, Eric Schmidt. The effect? When the strange personal endorsements show up across Google, it'll be Schmidt's face hawking a local bar or Duck Dynasty, not theirs. Google's new type of ads, in which restaurant ratings and long-forgotten YouTube comments can be repurposed with your name and Google Plus profile picture, is similar to Facebook's much protected sponsored stories. There's a way to opt out of the program, but it isn't much fun to dig up old pictures. They're having fun protesting this Google Plus advertising by using pictures of Eric Schmidt. Now, that's funny because they're grabbing the chairman of Google and using his picture so that his face shows up in all these ads. I'm wondering why they're doing that. I would think it would be much more effective if they used, say, I don't know, Goatsy or something Lemon nice Party. And offensive.
I'd say, you know, because then, you know, they're not going to use the image because it's adult content or something. Yeah, so what you do, you take Eric Schmidt and you make it look like he's got a cock in his mouth. But you don't use a cock. You use like a forearm, like somebody's forearm, just kind of Photoshop it in there. And that way you can't even get busted for having that. That way you can't even get busted for having adult content.
For some reason, it sounds like you might have done this in the past, Suave. Do you work for the press or whatever that makes all those pictures? And
no comment.
So the next time I'm trolling big.
I mean, I get the joke of why they're using Schmidt, but I just think there's so many better things they could use than just, you know, Google CEO. Okay, Goatsy might not be the best, example, but I mean, I just feel like there's all kinds of better things they could use. Or, you know, they could
just
go
to a sign saying, I don't endorse any products.
Yeah, that's kind of trite, though. I think you'd have better luck. I guess if you wanted to go that route, you could use, like, the anonymous face or, the V for Vendetta mask or something along those lines. But I don't know. I just, you know, just a, you know, a giant middle finger. I think, you know, that would work.
I don't know. Stop using Google Plus.
Yeah, there's that.
That would probably be the best way to get them to stop being morons.
Yeah, it's like what I talked about in the discussion. We should have just seen a mass exodus, everybody just shutting down their Google Plus accounts, and we haven't seen it.
Right.
But,
I don't think get a mass exodus for something that didn't get very big.
That's true.
I don't
true.
Think Google
That's
Plus
true.
Got big, did it?
Well, it kind of did, just because everybody with a Gmail account automatically got one. So, I mean, like, technically, I have a Google Plus, a bunch of people I know with Gmail accounts technically have Google Plus, never log into the damn thing, but we have one.
I believe they've also started generating Google Plus accounts for businesses, and then you can go in and, like, claim your Google Plus page.
Yeah. Zombies. Pictures of, like, a zombie face would be good. Like, you know, zombified masses. That would be good pictures to use.
Yeah.
No. I just thought of it. Gary Busey. Just everyone have random pictures of Gary Busey as their Google Plus profile pictures. Preferably the ones where like...
Like, you know, the crazy ones.
Yeah, the really crazy ones.
That's a good one.
That would be... I'd be afraid that one might actually endorse products, though, but I mean, that would at least work. So... next story up is from BBC. The head of Europe's crime fighting agency has warned that what do they have, like Superman there? The crime fighter agency. And it said police, come on. Has warned that of the growing risk of organized crime groups using cyber attacks to allow them to traffic drugs. The director of Europol, Rob Wainwright, says that the internet is being used to facilitate international drug trafficking business. His comments follow a cyber attack on the Belgian port of Antwerp. Drug traffickers recruited hackers to breach IT systems that controlled the movement and locations of containers. Police carried out a series of raids in Belgium and Holland earlier this year, seizing computer hacking equipment as well as large quantities of cocaine and heroin, guns, and a suitcase full of cash. So it sounds like they were playing payday. 15 people are currently awaiting trial in two countries. Mr. Wainwright said that the alleged plot demonstrates how the internet is being used as a freelance marketplace in which drug trafficking groups recruit hackers to help them carry out cyber attacks to order. The case is an example of how organized crime is becoming more enterprising, especially online, he says. We have effectively a service-oriented industry where organized crime groups are paying for specialist hacking skills that they can't acquire online, or that they can acquire online, he adds. The attack on the port of Antwerp is thought to have taken place over a two-year period from June 2011. Prosecutors say a Dutch-based trafficking group hid cocaine and heroin among legitimate cargo, including timber and bananas shipped in from South America. The organized crime group allegedly used hackers based in Belgium to infiltrate computer networks in at least two companies operating in the port of Antwerp. The breach allowed hackers to access secure data, giving them the location and security details of containers, meaning the traffickers could send in lorry drivers to steal the cargo before the legitimate owner arrived. So what they were doing was on their supply...
They got a hold of shipping.
Huh? Madman, we're losing you, man. They would load their drugs into a shipping container on the supply side. And then they would, you know, hack the receiving end and show up and, you know, receive the shipment earlier, fraudulently, and then use the hackers to cover up the existence of the thing at all. Workers were first alerted to the plot when entire containers began to disappear from the port without explanation. These criminal organizations always look for new ways to get drugs out of the harbor, said Danny Decree, who heads the Antwerp Organized Crime Unit of the Belgian Federal Police. In this case, they hired hackers who were of a very high level, intelligent guys, doing a lot of software work, he adds. He said the operation to hack the port companies took place in a number of phases, starting with malicious software being emailed to staff, allowing the organized crime group to access data remotely. When the initial breach was discovered and a firewall installed to prevent further attacks, hackers broke into the premises and fitted keylogging devices into the computers. I'm not sure they had the hackers do that. They might have had somebody else break in and hook them up. Keyloggers are actually fairly easy to install. This allowed them to gain wireless access to keystrokes typed by staff as well as screen grabs from their monitors. Mr. Decree says the total quantity of drugs trafficked by the group is unknown, but in a series of raids earlier this year, the police seized more than a ton of cocaine. Good God. A ton of cocaine. With a street value of 130 million euros. And a similar amount of heroin. A ton of heroin. My God. In January, a lorry driver unconnected to the plot, who was shot after he had unwittingly driven a container allegedly filled with cocaine from a terminal in Antwerp. The attack took place... Wow, okay. So the hacker, you know, somebody screwed up and didn't get the container before the lorry driver showed up. So they just showed up and shot him and took the truck. The attack took place in the province of Limburg, where suspects armed with AK-47 assault rifles fired at the driver, who was unharmed. Oh, they didn't shoot him. They just shot at him. Following the cyber attack in Antwerp, a joint operation by Belgium and Dutch police resulted in raids on more than 20 homes and businesses. Officers seized 6 firearms, including a machine gun and silencer, bulletproof vests, and 1.3 million euros in cash hidden in a suitcase. Yeah. Excuse me. So, that's kind of awesome. They were hacking into the ports to figure out when their containers full of drugs were showing up so they could just have somebody show up and receive shipment. And then I guess if the legitimate driver showed up, you know, they would just point a gun at him and say, get the hell out of here.
Right.
So
actually really smart.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
That's like some, the sort of stuff you see in a movie.
That's why I wanted to talk about the story. I think it's actually hilarious. I love the picture they showed, too, of the quote-unquote hacking equipment they've got, because it looks like they strung a bunch of random USB hubs together and then just, like, whatever they found laying around. And, of course, they took all the casing off everything, too, so it's all bare circuit boards to make it look more hackerish, I guess. But nice. The part I thought was the funniest was in the middle was the TP-Link W703. Yeah, the one you use to make a pirate box.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, one of those is right smack in the middle on the picture of the page. It's just like, well, I wonder if it was just a pirate box, or because I mean, you can load up all kinds of stuff on those things. So I just, yeah, that's just great. Let's see here. Next one up is from YLE.fi. Former Nokia boss Jorma Olia has admitted that the 2011 decision to focus Nokia's mobile phone production on devices running Microsoft software was a mistake, and it failed to provide the boost it may have helped Nokia challenge industry giants Apple and Android. It is impossible... Apple and Android, that's... Wouldn't it be Apple and Google, or iOS and Android? Anyways, it's impossible to estimate what would have happened to the company if different decisions had been made at the start of 2011, or at some other time, Olia told the Daily. Olia said that the company's biggest problem was software know-how, and that senior management and Nokia had tried to fix it since the 1990s without success. According to Olia, Nokia had wanted to focus on high-end smartphones, just as Apple did from 2007, but telecom operators, the main sales channel for the company, preferred to have a range of cheaper phones to offer to their customers. So, apparently, Nokia held off from making smartphones for a really long time, because all the cell phone companies were saying, no, we want the little cheap feature phones. And then when they finally tried to go into smartphones, they went Microsoft, and now they're saying, yeah, that was kind of a fuck up.
I'm such a fuck up. That.
Yeah. Seriously, I don't know anyone that has a Microsoft phone. Do you guys?
I knew a few people that had them and took them back.
Oh, wow. That might be even worse.
I've actually tried one.
I know one person who had one, and he did like it. But it doesn't even matter if it was the best OS ever, and you know, it might be actually quite good. There's no app ecosystem or anything like that, and that'll completely kill any sort
of smartphone.
That's
why they took it back. They couldn't get anything for the phone.
Yeah,
that's a good point.
So the only thing that phone had going for it was a whack ass camera, a 48 megapixel camera on it, but that wasn't enough to justify keeping the phone. So, and it was a Nokia phone.
Which is really too bad, because there's nothing I want more than an awesome Nokia smartphone.
They know how to design. They really do.
Nokia was my go-to phone until I got a smartphone.
So they just... Well, maybe now that they're admitting it... Well, the thing is, the guy doesn't work there anymore. Now he works for Shell. But,
yeah, didn't they just get sold or something?
I think Microsoft bought a major stake in them, so I don't think that they're going to turn around and start making Android phones anytime soon, because that would save them. If they just dropped the Windows stuff and started making Android, you know, they'd be great. But with Microsoft buying them, I don't see it happening anytime soon.
Yeah.
Or a major stake in them, I'm not sure if they bought them outright or not. I don't know. Well, anyways.
Maybe Microsoft is going to fix the content side of it.
No, they're going to try to convince people that they should, but... Everything Microsoft, the only thing Microsoft has managed to branch out of outside of the Windows ecosystem has been Xbox.
Right.
Yeah.
And even that's not been the total victory they want.
No, not at all. I'm guessing the Steam Box is going to take another chunk out of their market share on that one.
Oh, easily.
Hopefully.
So. Yeah, I don't know. Microsoft's been coasting for so long, I kind of want to see them taking down a few pegs so they'll actually start designing good stuff again.
Yeah, actually, we were just talking about that at work today, because, you know, I haven't looked through the notes yet. You're talking about Windows 8.1? Oh, man. But
no, I intentionally avoided the whole Windows 8.1 thing, because I really don't fucking care.
Yeah, well, we were talking about it at work, and it's really about time. They need to fail, so just like you said, so they actually are forced to realize, oh, we aren't so big, you know, that we can't fail, and no people are buying this shit. Let's try to make something good.
With Windows 7 being, you know, really well done, they kind of got the feeling that they could do no wrong, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, oops.
No, the big problem time is oops. They do something good, like Windows 7, it loved the operating system. It's when they're trying to do shit and then just not putting enough money into it or getting the right know-how behind it. Your smartphone could be great. Some people have smartphones isn't to make phone calls. It's to do all the other little crap on a smartphone. They need to get to content providers and actually get that fixed. So maybe being less douchebaggish in their marketing, maybe? Or not marketing, but their vendors.
No, they're
trying
still
to attract
trying to run
people to their system.
They're still trying to run their vendors into the ground. The apparently HP put out a thing a couple of while back, but that they actually hate dealing with Microsoft at this point. And I know Dell went private because they wanted to get out of PC altogether. They want to start making other stuff.
Right. Well, look at just the licensing and crap that they have to do. Like the. You have to use, you know, their IDEs to develop software, and I forget who it was. I read some game software development company was like, you know what, we're making this on Xbox because just the licensing to get their IDE that they force you to develop in is ridiculous. It's way too pricey.
Oh, the XMA stuff? Yeah.
Yeah, they need to get knocked down a peg and realize people aren't going to pay, you know, a ridiculous amount of money just to build software for their hardware.
The thing I don't get is Microsoft's core meal ticket has always been business machines. Active Directory, Windows desktops, business software. That's been what pays their bills. And then they turn out Windows 8, which is quite obviously an iPad knockoff, consumer-based, you know, Candyland bullshit operating system. I can't see any business seriously running Windows 8. Now, we're going to end up with it, and eventually, I know a lot of places will. And I've talked to several of our support guys who actually kind of like the whole idea because it hides so much of the OS that users who don't need to get into some of the guts of the system are going to have a harder time doing it. Because, you know, that here's your little widgets, here's the six applications you use every day. So, I mean, if you're going to set up a managed appliance for people, it's not so bad, but the thing looks so damn goofy. I mean, and I don't know about you guys, but trying to use it with a mouse, I mean, you've got to have a touchscreen for that interface.
Yeah, that's the other major bitch, obviously, everyone has for it's... They cannot try to pull an Apple and say, oh yeah, we got one OS across everything. It just does not freaking work.
Yeah.
And plus, think of all the old hardware out there.
Oh yeah, you can't touch it.
Oh, it freaking... Well, no, just because if they're going to develop something that requires a touchscreen, touchscreens are not very prominent. I mean, they're just now becoming affordable and more prominent. I hate the fact that they're trying to force people to say, oh, yep, Windows XP, not supported anymore. Oh, yep, you don't have a touchscreen? Oh, go out and buy more. You know, that pisses me off. I don't want them to tell me what I have to buy.
Go ahead, Swolf.
I honestly don't even think that touchscreens are going to catch on for a desktop environment.
They're not comfortable.
Well, it's not comfortable. It's not productive at all. Like, if you're using a mouse or a trackball or something like that, you just have to, like, wiggle your wrist a little bit, and you have full control over your computer. Otherwise, you're, like, actually having to physically swing your arms around. And if you're doing that all day long, or you're, like, trying to type something and then do something on the screen, then type, like, it doesn't work.
It's not productive. It doesn't work with the way we currently lay out our desktops. To make it work, you have to take your screen and lay it on the table at an angle like you would a tablet, and then put the keyboard in front of it. And even then, that's not terribly productive. And it's great for your neck, let me tell you.
Yeah.
But the whole thing's a fucking joke. It really is. I know Laser has a Windows 8 tablet. He really does. And he has to hook a keyboard and mouse up to it because that interface is so broken, he can't navigate it with just the on-screen stuff. He can't.
Right.
And
right.
It's not that he doesn't know how to use it, because he and I have both looked at that thing trying to figure it out. He knows how to get around the interface just fine. Buttons aren't there on the on-screen keyboard. It is missing buttons. So,
wow.
I mean, you physically cannot navigate it without a Bluetooth keyboard. He was showing you that at the meetup, Suave.
Yeah, it's true.
I mean...
Yeah, I saw it too, dude. Yeah, that's exactly right.
I mean... I just, damn. How did we get on that? Next, let's go to the next story. pisses me off. TheRegister.co.uk. The websites of freebie antivirus vendors AVG and Avira, as well as mobile messaging service WhatsApp, appear to have been hit by a DNS redirection attack today, which sends users to pro-Palestinian websites. A team of hacktivists calling themselves KDMS have claimed credit for the hacks. Visitors to AVG.com were greeted by a rendition of the Palestinian national anthem via an embedded YouTube video and a message from a pro-Palestinian group calling itself the KDMS team, instead of the usual security tips and links to anti-malware downloads. It's clearly embarrassing for a security company to be hit in this fashion by hackers, but there's no indication of any customer information or sensitive data has been compromised. Well, no, with a DNS redirection, that just means the URL was going to the wrong place. Writes Graham Cluley, a veteran of the antivirus industry turned independent security consultant. It's possible that the hackers managed to change the website's DNS records, redirecting anybody who attempted to visit AVG.com to a different IP address. A blog post by Cluley featuring a screenshot of the AVG defacement can be found on the Register page. Security experts were quick to discover that all three victims using Hosting Biz Network Solutions as their DNS provider. Hackers may have exploited security shortcomings at network solutions to alter DNS records to gain control of the target's domains. The KDMS team claims an affiliation with the Anonymous Palestine group. The same group pulled off a similar DNS hijack redirection against the website hosting firm LeaseWeb over the weekend. LeaseWeb's statement on the attack can be found... Okay, they got a link to that. LeaseWeb denied earlier reports that a vulnerability in its WHMCS billing and support system might have been responsible for the hijack, but without naming a cause. The hosting firm is seeking to play down the significance of the attack, which it characterizes as regrettable but superficial and quickly resolved. Yeah, sure it was. You know, it only shakes confidence in your entire operation there. That's regrettable. Yeah, that's just...
The only thing they do is direct traffic on the internet, so wouldn't that be a substantial thing when traffic is being directed to the wrong website?
So...
That's like, I don't know, Kroger saying, I'm sorry, we couldn't sell you groceries for how many ever hours. But it's only a slight problem with our business model.
It's funny because the thing is, what they did was they defaced the page. They didn't do the really, really nasty trick of cloning the original website and filling all the download links with, you know, the fake antivirus bullshit that used to happen. And that used to be a big thing.
Like you said, all they did is redirect the DNS, so it just went to a different server. So they didn't, they didn't really hack. From what I read, the best title that I saw about this, it said hacking like it's 1964. Supposedly they faxed in like a password reset form, and that's how they got access to those sites' DNS.
Socially engineered it. Nice.
Yeah, they social engineered it. They faxed in a form that said, hey, we need to do a password reset, and VeriSign or I forget whoever runs the DNS was like, okay, we've reset your password to 1234. Go ahead. And they just redirected the domain to, you know, a server that they controlled. So it wasn't really, like I said, it's more social engineering. It wasn't exactly.
Oh, I wish I had found that article now instead of this one. That sounds like it was a much better read.
Yeah, yeah. But like I said, I love the title, Hacking Like It's 1964.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Anyways. All right. Let's see here. Next story up is from Torrent Freak. In a new filing submitted to California Federal Court, the MPAA says that the actual piracy damages, and I quote, are not capable of meaningful measurement. Something we've said every time they've quoted numbers. The group fears that looking at actual damages in the ISO Hunt case would be perverse and unfair. Looking at the actual damages would be unfair. What the MPAA
so it's not fair to say what I've done to you.
What the MPAA can measure, I'm not going to get through the story without losing it, however, is how much it will take to bankrupt the BitTorrent search engine ISO Hunt. According to the movie studios, $2 to $5 million will be enough to put the Canadian company out of business. As the trial date moves closer, the arguments between the MPAA and BitTorrent search engine ISO Hunt are heating up. One of the issues the two parties are in disagreement over is whether ISO Hunt should be able to question the notion that piracy is actually hurting the movie industry. To argue that piracy might not be as disastrous as it's often portrayed, the Torrent site has listed researcher and economics professor Coleman Strumpf as one of its witnesses. Strumpf's research has previously shown that piracy is not hurting sales at all, and that ISO Hunt is expected to use this in its favor during the trial. The MPAA, however, prefers not to discuss the topic of actual damages during the trial. That's a line of the century right there. The MPAA,
isn't that
however,
the point of a copyright trial?
Prefers not to discuss the topic of actual damages during the trial.
That's argue the purpose of the trial, is to see if you were injured in any way, and to make you whole.
They argue that the issue is too complex and it could mislead the jury. For example, ISO Hunt may be able to show that the movie industry profits are increasing, but that doesn't mean piracy had no effect. The movie studios are therefore asking the court to exclude the issue, arguing that actual damages cannot be measured.
Then how the hell are they going to fine ISO Hunt if actual damages can't be measured? They might have only done a cent worth of damage. Here's your penny. Go fuck away.
I just noticed Sard's been posting the links. Good job, Sard.
I remember this time. Yay. Well, I remember by like the third story, but anyway.
Yeah.
Good enough.
Yeah, yeah. So I'll post the notes when I post the show anyway, so you can get all the links then. The movie studios are therefore arguing that the court are asking the court to exclude the issue, arguing that actual damages cannot be measured. To permit consideration of actual damages under these circumstances would be perverse and particularly unfair, given that the plaintiffs elected statutory damages precisely because their actual damages are not capable of meaningful measurement, the MPAA's legal team writes. We wanted statutory damages because we can't win the other argument. That's what they're saying. The MPAA argues that since the court has decided to award statutory damages, it is irrelevant to what extent their revenues are negatively impacted by online piracy. The defendant should not be permitted to exploit the inherent difficulty in proving actual damages in a case such as this because of a bias for lowering the statutory damages award, especially when the very purpose of statutory damages was to provide a remedy that is not dependent on proof of actual damages. Yeah, that's actually kind of true. That's the whole point of statutory. While the MPAA admits that the effect of online piracy is nearly impossible to measure, the movie studios do have a very clear picture of what's needed to bankrupt ISO Hunt. The transcript from a recent court meeting reveals that two to 5 million should exhaust the company. They even have the transcript right here. Court, what do you estimate the resources of the defendants? What do you suspect? MPAA's counsel. Based on our estimate, Your Honor, we believe a couple to a few million dollars would exhaust Mr. Fung's or defendant's ability to pay. MPAA counsel. A couple to a few million dollars would exhaust the... That's pasted weird. Court, does that mean it's like $2 million? Counsel, $2 million to $4 million, $5 million at the most. The court... When the court asked the MPAA's counsel why it was going for nearly $600 million in damages, when a few million would be enough to put the company out of business, the MPAA argued that they are asking for $600 million against ISO Hunt. Damn. I didn't realize that was the number they were going after. The MPAA argued that the high amount is needed to deter others from starting their own torrent search engines. In a reply to the MPAA's opposition, ISO Hunt argues that the actual damages are important information for the jury to have, so a more balanced sum can be reached. If there's no proof of piracy hurting the movie industry, a $3 million fine might be more appropriate than $600 million. Evidence on plaintiff's overall and specific revenues relating to the works at issue will allow the jury to infer that the plaintiffs have not suffered any actual damages, which can be contrasted with the financial condition of the defendants and the jury fashioning an appropriate award, ISO Hunt's counsel argues. For example, if plaintiffs enjoyed uninterrupted profits and their overall revenues did not decline during the time that ISO Hunt was launched and defendants began complying with the injunction, the jury could conclude that it would be unjust and a windfall to award plaintiffs anything more than the near $3 million statutory minimum. So, I see. The statutory damages can range from $3 million to $600 million. So, of course, the MPAA is going for the max, and ISO Hunt's trying to argue for the minimum. The court now have to decide whether the issue of actual damages can be brought up in court. If that's the case, then the trial is going to be a numbers game with experts on all sides trying to prove whether or not piracy is hurting Hollywood. I hope it does, because I want to see the arguments on both sides. I really do. I hope that they let the arguments go through, because that'll be awesome reading.
Right.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, like I said, that's the whole point of the trial, though, is of whether or not you're hurt. Well, it's like a defamation suit.
The idea... Well, no, it's not a defamation suit. It's a copyright suit. It's, well, go ahead, Mevin.
The point of a copyright suit is still, this guy damaged me, give me money. You have to show how much you were damaged.
Right, but this particular form of copyright infringement has statutory damages on it, so you could go into court and say, I can't prove actual damages, but the law says, you can go for statutory. So that's the argument they're making. It sounds hilarious, though, that we can't prove actual damages, so we're going for the statutory. I mean, it does sound pretty hilarious.
So,
I hope the judge has balls enough to say no statutory damages.
It definitely seems to be a far cry from how it was a couple of years ago when they were, what was it, like $100,000 per song that people were downloading there trying to charge them for?
I think that's where the $6 million number is coming from.
Oh, okay.
And I mean, every time I get a DMCA complaint at work, they're asking for right at about $4,000 per song.
Oh, okay. I feel like that's gone down quite a bit from what it was in the early days.
Well, that's because when they're crazy big numbers. 4K per song,
but they're like 99 cents.
Well, the reason they're doing that is because when they're these crazy big numbers, well, you might as well go to court because either way you're screwed, right?
Yeah,
but when it's like $4,000, well, what's the cost of a lawyer and taking him to court? Well, it's probably more like $8,000-$9,000. You'll just pay $4,000 to make it go away. That's the whole economic argument for it. So it doesn't make it to court that often because it's more expensive to argue it than to just pay them to go away. It's extortion, but it's I guess it's legal extortion. Huh. Yeah, it kind of sucks.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is, though. It's extortion.
So, anyways. Next one up is from Ars Technica. Nate Anderson. Oh, this is the funny story. And, I'm always trying to have like a weird or goofy story or something out there for the last story. You're going to love this one. Nate Anderson gave a one-hour talk at the University of Michigan on remote administration tools, RATs, and the surprising way they allow hackers, corporations, schools, and the police to spy on computer users by activating microphones and webcams. The talk contained some pretty wild stories, but a woman approached him afterward to let him know that the craziest single ratting story she had ever heard just took place up the road in Detroit. The actual rat attack in question doesn't sound particularly novel, except that this case, the target was not a young woman. The more typical victim, especially when it comes to voyeurism or sextortion. But a young man named Hector Hernandez. The 17-year-old high school student's computer was infected with a rat, which the software owner used to spy on Hernandez and eventually record a quote-unquote embarrassing video of him. Embarrassing video of a teenage guy in front of his computer. Gee, I wonder what it is. The rat owner then approached Hernandez through his Facebook account and demanded money. First $300, then $1,100, or the video would be released to the world. Hernandez offers no clues as to the content of the video. A long list of scenarios is not difficult to imagine. But in an on-camera interview with Detroit's Fox affiliate, he makes clear that he simply couldn't bring himself to tell his parents about the situation. The video was so shameful to Hernandez that instead of going to the police or his parents, he instead took an estimated $100,000 worth of family heirlooms and jewelry down the street to a pawn shop. He showed them his ID, which made it clear he was only 17, but the pawn shop took the jewelry anyways and gave him a mere $1,500 for the lot.
Ouch.
Excuse me. Hernandez then wired the money to an address in the Philippines that had been provided to him by the blackmailer. Predictably, this didn't put an end to the extortion. When the blackmailer demanded more cash and Hernandez simply couldn't acquire any, he finally told his parents and then told the police. Hernandez and his mother both spoke to Fox Detroit about the case, and the video is really worth watching. I didn't link to it, but when I post the show notes, you can get to it from the article. The reporter lays it on a bit thick, calling rat spying something despicable people and pathetic voyeurs, perverts, and criminals do, but the clip puts a very human face on the problem. While blackmail has always been with us, this kind of international extortion didn't generally affect teens still living in their families' homes. The mother weeping is also a reminder that in these situations, going to the parents or the police is usually a better idea than trying to work with the extortionists, especially if stealing jewelry from your parents is the only way you're going to raise the cash. The family is now desperately trying to retrieve their items from the pawn shop, but it doesn't seem like they're going to get them.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, the pawn shop really took advantage of them there, but...
Wait, a pawn shop taking advantage of people?
No. I'm going to have to get my guy on jewelry in here. Yeah, he said that's only worth about $1,500.
You guys ever seen Pawn Stars?
I fucking hate
that. Oh, let's get our
show
expert in here to take a look at that. Oh, it's worth $5,000. Okay, I'll give you $25 for it. Fucking jerks.
But, yeah, I just, man. And that's out there. He stole jewelry from his parents to give to an extortionist. I mean, let's be real. What's the video? Him enjoying porn or something?
Walking
he's,
off.
He's probably not out of the closet yet or something like that.
But I don't think they can see what he's whacking off to. It'd just be him whacking off.
Yeah.
And this is a good point.
So unless he's got like the volume up, and you're capturing, I don't know, two guys or a guy and a goat making strange noises.
Hey, it's whatever it is, it was enough to make him steal jewelry from his family and send it to a stranger.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's just... yeah, kids, this is why it's important to put the tape over the webcam.
Yeah.
I, whoever's spying on me from my computer...
You want to see something here? I'll show you something.
Guys.
I almost want to set up a dummy machine, let it get ratted, and just like have a horrible picture printed out and held up in front of the camera. First thing, you got to print the picture, but you know, it's sort of like you know, you want to set up. Oh, I know what you do. You know, just because at this point you're just wanting to screw with them, right? You want to set up as many dummy machines as you can, let them get ratted. And just point, you know, use a little bit of software to point the webcam at a window for chat roulette.
Oh, yeah. The mini cam.
Yeah, use that and just let it run. Let, you know. Yeah, go ahead. Rat it. Yeah, go right ahead. I say, here you go.
Like, so, how many penises did you really want to look at today?
Okay, it is time for this.
Hadouken!
either need an intro for this that's less racist or more racist. I'm not sure which.
More.
Yeah, you would say that. We're supposed to be making fun of old kung fu movies, but it somehow moved just to flat out racism. So let's talk about encryption. So with all this NSA crap and everything going on around, they're calling for the old intro in the chat room. I can play the old intro. I should have it. Where is it?
Me love you long time.
There we go. Okay. So let's talk encryption. Less racist, more funny. Yeah. I'd like that too, Psychros. I'd like that too. All right. So TrueCrypt. I talk about TrueCrypt a lot, but I've never really gone into kind of what it does, kind of how to use it. And it's really hard to do a how to use it on audio, right? So anyways, I'm talking TrueCrypt here because it's really the best we have in a bad situation. In fact, there's a nice article in the Register that's only a couple of days old that goes through and picks it apart because there's some problems with the open source that they put out for TrueCrypt. Apparently, researchers haven't been able to build the same binary that's on the website. So a lot of people are worried that TrueCrypt might be backdoored. But Bruce Schneier actually has a fairly nice quote in the article. And he says, no, he doesn't have any inside knowledge about TrueCrypt, but there's a lot about it that makes me suspicious. But for Windows full disk encryption, it's TrueCrypt, Microsoft's BitLocker, or Symantec's PGP disk. And I'm more worried about large U.S. corporations being pressured by the NSA than he is about TrueCrypt. And, you know, TrueCrypt's documentation does make it plain that it can't secure data on a computer compromised by malware or a keyboard logger. It's well known in forensic circles that TrueCrypt keys can be recovered from memory. So, you know, it's not perfect. Obviously, you have to know what you're doing with it to have a clue. And I think he's right. I think TrueCrypt is a lot less likely to have a major backdoor in it than BitLocker or PGP. And even if it does have a backdoor in it, that's not one they're going to want to reveal anytime soon that they've got. So, but there are a lot of articles out there about TrueCrypt potentially being backdoor. But, you know, again, if there is a backdoor, they don't want to expose it. And there's been a lot of people looking for it for a long time, so I'm not sure that there's one there. And if you think about it, you'd have to be fairly high up on the list of shit they're wanting to see for them to actually risk exposing a backdoor in any kind of a court case. So I don't think they're going to do that for just anybody. You're going to have get pretty damn good reason for them to risk that in court. Now, I guess if it's international spying or something like that, that's a little bit different case, but I'm mostly focusing on people in the States, and they're, you know, for that, they're going to have to go to court, and they're not going to want to have to reveal that they had a backdoor to the program. So, but most modern OSs do have some sort of built-in encryption tool. They're not cross-platform, and as Schneier points out, they could have been pressured to have backdoors installed, because we know for a fact that NSA was going to the courts and basically forcing these companies to do this. And since TrueCrypt is kind of this open-source cross-platform, or I guess mostly open-source, forcing a backdoor into the thing would be really hard. Now, I see them talking about DDCrypt in the chat room. I've not played with that one. It looked decent, but I haven't looked at it, so I don't know. But anyways, so I guess kind of generally, if you haven't thought about encrypting your hard disk, there's all kinds of really good reason to do that, and most of them don't even have anything to do with the NSA. Even if, you know, you're using a Microsoft or a Symantec one that, you know, possibly could have backdoors in it. Because even if it has the backdoors, you're still knocking out a ton of attacks. No sideloading malware from live bootable media, because without the backdoor, they can't do that. And even then, they probably have to clone the drive and decrypt all of it. So there's no easy way to clone it. There's no, I mean, there's just, it makes the drive inaccessible without the password, and unless there's a backdoor, but at that point, they're probably going to have to confiscate the machine anyway, so you'll kind of know what's up. I mean, if they really want your stuff, they're going to take your machine, and then they're just going to beat the password out of you with the $5 wrench. So you've kind of got more serious concerns at that point, right?
Okay.
If anybody doesn't know what I mean by the $5 wrench, it's an XKCD comic where they point out somebody going absolutely nuts with the encryption and, you know, people trying to crack it, and it's like, no, 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 they're just going to tie you up and beat you till you give them the password, dude. So, you know, as opposed to building the $10,000 Beowulf cluster to crack your encryption, they're just going to beat the password out of you. But yeah. Oh, they're asking, is it difficult? No, encrypting the entire hard drive is not difficult. Depending on what encryption you use, though, TrueCrypt installs into boot sector 0 on the hard disk a little decryption routine so that it can actually boot. And there, in the past, there's been other software that puts stuff there. So you want to watch out and maybe Google a little bit the software you're running. Make sure there's not going to be any conflict with TrueCrypt. Adobe used to put its DRM software there. So you would have you would have Adobe removing the little thing that lets you read your hard disk. So you could still make a boot USB to get around that. So you do want to make the little boot recovery drive so you can still decrypt the drive if something goes wrong. But the nice thing about TrueCrypt is it's actually cross-platform, but it will do Windows full disk encryption. And they're asking about the hidden volumes. Yeah, what you can do with that is with TrueCrypt, you can do what's called a plausible deniability volume, and that's where when you enter the decryption, you actually have two passwords. You have the one that you're supposed to hem and haw a little bit and then give up, and then you have another one, which is the real one. So you can't tell from one, the way the drive is scrambled, of course, you can't tell that there's more than one volume hidden on the drive. So, and yeah, being able to give up the password is supposed to get you around the torture problem, but that's only if you don't know how torture actually works. you don't just twist somebody's fingernails off with the pliers until they give you the information. You actually ask them a question you already know the answer to while twisting their fingernails off. You have to train them so that they can't lie to you, kind of thing. So in the case of these passwords, that's a little bit difficult because they twist your fingernails, you ask them for the password, you finally give them the give-up password, and what they're looking for isn't in there, so they're going to start working on you again until you give them the other password. So you've got to really, really weigh your... You know, that's a really dark scenario to be in. At that point, I'd give them the password and hope for the best. I don't know about you guys. I don't know that I have something worth losing, like, you know, really severe torture.
This is mostly just going to get you around the cops arresting you in the States, yeah, or someone stealing your laptop.
No, that's a good idea. JNT's has a good idea in the chat room there about loading VMs inside of the hidden volume. That's a great idea to wrap it up in multiple layers. If you're dealing with something that crazy, though, at that point, I would recommend not putting it in a computer. I mean, if you've got something that out there that you're that worried about, I wouldn't put it in a computer, because if it's only in your head, at least in the States, you cannot be compelled to reveal that information. I'm trying to see it there. It's info suggesting TrueCrypt for Windows is actually less secure than TrueCrypt for Windows. I'm not sure what you're talking about there, Cycros. Okay. You're talking about VMs in TrueCrypt, and I'm not keeping up with that conversation. So, anyways, so the most straightforward way to use TrueCrypt, you know, doing the full disk encryption is awesome and is great fun, and it really screws with people trying to sideload crap into your machine. Or if they're trying to, you know, just go in and get certain files, of course they can't do that. They got to clone the whole drive and then try to crack it. So it's kind of a pain in the ass. And, you know, if customs is keeping your machine for, you know, hours at a time, you might get a clue of what's up. But anyways, the way I like to use TrueCrypt, especially if you're moving files between two endpoints, is you set up a container file. And this is kind of the first way to use TrueCrypt. And I'm not sure that TrueCrypt can actually do the full disk encryption on Mac and Linux yet. I know it can do it on Windows, but I'm not sure they ever got it working on Linux. And Linux has a few other options for full disk encryption using LVM and a few other things. So anyways, though, what you create is a container file. And essentially, it's a lot like a virtual machine's hard disk. It's you know, a raw image, kind of, except it's encrypted. And one of the nice things about TrueCrypt is it'll actually ask you which encryption scheme you want to use. You can use Blowfish, you know, one of the RSA, Triple Des, whatever. So, you know, it's got a few different options in there for how you want to encrypt this container file. And the nice thing is you can actually, once you're done, you close the container file. I guess I'm getting ahead of myself here. So you make the container file. And TrueCrypt will actually mount it on your machine as a drive. So it kind of shows up like a flash drive or a thumb drive. And at that point, after you've created it, and you go through the process to create it, it's got a little wizard to walk you through the process. It's not difficult at all. You know, it'll ask you how big do you want it to be, where do you put it, what encryption do you want, and then finally what passphrase or file do you want to use for a passphrase. So you could actually take a JPEG, and that JPEG is actually going to be what the system uses to generate the hash that it uses for the encryption. So, you know, you could use a picture as your password or any file, really. So once you've done that, it creates this container file and mounts it as another drive. So it shows up like a flash drive. So if you say, make me a 1 gig image file, it might mount it, let's say, on G, just to pick a drive letter, and it'll look like a 1 gig flash drive, right? And anything you put in there, TrueCrypt is going to encrypt in whatever encryption scheme you told it for that container file. And, you know, if you think when, you know, obviously you want to try to pick the algorithm that you think is best, and you can even set, for some of them, you can even set how many, you know, bits to use. So you can go really nuts with, different versions. They're saying that they've had problems with Windows TrueCrypt and Linux TrueCrypt. Last time I've tried it, I've never actually had a problem. It worked just fine for me. Now, it didn't preserve permissions, but you could still move the files around in it without too big of a problem. I think it was a FAT32 formatted disk image. But I haven't seen that problem in a long time. But I haven't done that much with it lately as far as moving files between machines. But the nice thing with TrueCrypt container files is once you're done, you unmount them, and then you've just got this file, right? And it's going to be as big as whatever size you set. So if you set maybe a 1 gig file, it's going to be 1 gig. So, yeah, it'll be that size. So if you're going to email the thing around, maybe you want to make something a little bit smaller, say, you know, 10, 20 megs, something like that, just big enough to hold whatever it is you're sending with a little bit of pad space or something. But when you're done, you unmount the container file and you send it off for wherever. And for God's sakes, don't send the password or the file you're using for a password along with the container file. You want to communicate that through some separate medium. So, like, if I was going to give Madman a file, well, he's fairly local to me, so I might hand him the flash drive and then email him the password. Or, even better, you know, email him the file and then hand him the password, you know, physically in person, right? If I wanted to send something to Sard, I might email him the file and then go force him to, what would be a good one? Force him to log into some game that nobody really, Second Life, force him to log into Second Life and then send him the password in a file in Second, you know, some bullshit like that, right? And make sure it's not obvious that's what it's for. So, you know, use a couple of different communication means so that you're sure who you're talking to and that you're sure you're giving them the right information without making it obvious as to what somebody's looking at. So, you know, just use some common sense on that. And, you know, they're arguing about the encryption of TrueCrypt in the chat room, which is awesome. TrueCrypt has a really good reputation when it comes to brooding. I believe it was in Brazil they caught somebody they thought had kiddie porn on a couple of external drives that were TrueCrypt encrypted. And they tried for something like 5 years to crack it and never got in. So, you know, I mean, it's pretty good as far as being brute force resistant. Now, you have to use a good password, obviously, if somebody guesses your... If your password is 1234, guess what? It's going to be on WordList, and they're going to get in. So, you know, use a good password. I especially like being able to use a file as a password, because especially if you can make it some innocuous file that's easy to remember. The one thing we did try once, and I this was a long time ago we tried this, and we discovered it's a really bad idea. We thought we were going to be really clever and use one of the Windows system files as the encryption file, right? Because then you wouldn't have to actually send the file. You just say, oh, just go use this. That file, you know, you just send them the path to the file. Well, that works until the Windows update comes out.
Oh, no.
And at that point, nobody can get back into the encrypted container. And we lost a class project, had to recreate it fairly quickly because but that we thought we were being really clever, and we also thought we had picked a file that wouldn't be touched by updates, and we were just, you know, wrong. So if you are going to use an encryption file, you might want to keep a backup of that file somewhere. So let's see, what are they're talking about? Public key crypto at this point. Yeah, actually the way the NSA was breaking SSL was, instead of breaking the encryption, they were going straight to the CAs and demanding the keys. That's actually what happened with LavaBit, was they just demanded the freaking SSL keys straight up. So, you know, that's what's going on there. But, yeah, crypto is a lot of fun. You just have to put some thought into how you're using it. If you don't trust your crypto program, you can still use it because it's at least going to break a lot of standard stuff. You know, for example, let's say TrueCrypt does have a backdoor in it. Do you think some idiot at Customs is going to have access to it on a flash drive right there? Probably not. And even then, they're still going to have to decrypt the whole drive, probably copying it onto something else in the process. So, you know, if it's somebody getting a hold of your machine for 5 minutes, trying to put something on it, you know, trying to put the keylogger in it, whatever, you know, even if there's a backdoor in the encryption, it's going to prevent them from doing that. The backdoors are going to be a pain in the butt in two instances. One, somebody steals, you know, somebody gets your hands on your machine, is going to keep it for a long period of time and actually has access to the backdoor. Or two, somebody finds the backdoor and figures out a way to exploit it fairly quickly. That's the real problem with them. The whole idea of only the good guys can use the backdoor is kind of a non-starter. That doesn't happen. But I don't know. I kind of the overview of TrueCrypt is fairly risk there, but that's because really it's wizards kind of take care of everything, so it's not a difficult thing to use. It is difficult to explain to normal people how to do the whole mounting and unmounting of containers, especially like if the mistake I used to make is I'd keep the container file on a flash drive, right? So you'd hand that to somebody and say, here, and go mount the image file, and they'd get confused because it was already, it's like, well, I already plugged the drive in, why isn't it showing, you know, that kind of thing. So geez, they're actually getting into talking about RAND and SRAND. They're talking about the C RAND generators. It's awesome. Oh, yeah. Cycros, you want to have a lot of fun for a random number generator. You get yourself an Arduino, a photo resistor, and a little keychain laser, you know, a little laser pointer. And just watch, you know, just have it send whatever value it's reading up the serial chain, and just, you know, flash the laser at it in random patterns, and you'll get all kinds of good random numbers from that way. I think MIT did something like that with lava lamps. So, but yeah, you can make some good hardware random number generators with an Arduino and a sensor. So, yeah, that would actually be, and I ought to build that sometime. It wouldn't even be all that hard. I'm not sure what good it would do, but I mean, it'd be fun to put together, you know? It's like, well, it reads the barometric pressure and the time, and we've got just a couple of floating open pins we occasionally read the value from. yeah, D D20s work well enough. Yeah, we'll just make the Arduino roll a D20 and report that back to the computer. There you go. Let's see.
The volume of the seismograph that you rolled the D20 on.
Yeah. We can do better. More random. Okay, that's enough of that. Let's see. Of course, listen to the stream. We're always working on it, and I'm going to be doing a ton of work on it here in the next couple of weeks. Of course, peer decking every Thursday, shoot the noise on Wednesdays. Did you all skip? Does anybody know? Did we skip shoot the noise this week? I don't know. I was running around yesterday, so I would have missed it. Let's see. Of course, you know, missing dialogues on Tuesdays. I have nothing on Saturdays. The Galaxy 15 radio site, the Twitter handle. The Twitter handle, the Galaxy 15 radio sim on OS Grid, the feedback forum, the subreddit, smoke signals, and I guess if you really want to, you can email naked photos of yourselves to Big Brother. That's Big Brother at Galaxy 15 radio. I don't think I missed anything in the promos there. Did I miss anything? You guys know of anything? Oh yeah, let's get drunk tomorrow. And of course, drunken anime plot on the Fridays that Let's Get Drunk isn't. So I need to update that promo block because I'm trying to do all that from memory at this point. That's really all I've got. I kind of blew right through TrueCrypt here. Did you guys have anything to add to that before I close out the show here?
No, man. You covered it pretty well, I think.
Cool.
Like I said, I saw some links today on... like you said, how it hasn't really been proven. They've actually started like a Kickstarter, although I don't think it's Kickstarter, but something similar to that to actually raise money to get a cryptography company to do a full audit on it and actually prove that, you know, whether it's legitimate or not.
Oh, geez.
Or has any vulnerabilities. So hopefully that'll happen.
I'd be interested to see the results of that. So, all right, that's something to play with. Anyways, so I'm going to hit play on this music now.